tonight's speaker, Jeremy T., a member of the We Are Not Saints group of Quincy, Massachusetts. Thank you.
Good evening. Happy Halloween. My name is Jeremy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jeremy. We love you, Jeremy. Lots and lots and lots.
Punches.
Thank you. Seems like an excellent time to go and smoke. Good luck. I would like to... This is way too echoey for me, and I talk way too loud. How's that? A little better. Good. I'd like to thank Jenna for asking me to come. I'd like to thank their committee for having me and all the hard work that they have done throughout the entire weekend and what is yet to come. They've done an excellent job. Can you please... help me thank them. Excellent job. Wonderful. Thank you so much. I served on a host committee putting on one of these YPODs. It was in Keene, New Hampshire, and it takes a lot of work. It's a labor of love. Thank you. So let's get down to the nitty-gritty. My sobriety date is February 5th, 2011. My home group is the We Are Not Saints group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a young people's meeting in Quincy, Massachusetts. It meets from 7 to 8 on 40 Beale Street in Quincy, Mass. every Saturday. You're all welcome. It's actually just turned, it just ended 40 minutes ago. So welcome to everybody who's new. That was awesome. You got a lot of newcomers. Somebody's doing it right. So if this is your first time... I have a job. It's a very simple job. I do it a lot. My instructions are in here. I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what I am like today. It actually explains that each person, each teller in the back of the book, each of these personal stories, each individual describes from their own point of view, using their own language, how they established a relationship with God. I did not come to AA to establish a relationship with God. So if you didn't either, welcome. And my sponsor has always given me an additional set of instructions. He tells me that it's my job to share my experience and share it honestly. And he always tells me this when I'm a corrections guy, he was a corrections guy. When you go into jails, you carry the message, and generally, they don't even pay attention. They're not listening, and it pisses me off. And it doesn't make any sense to me because you would think, I'm the one that's not in jail, so thus they would pay attention to the one guy that's not in jail, but they don't, and that's okay, and I get annoyed. My sponsor just reminds me what my job is, share my experience and share it honestly. So if your experience like doesn't quite line up with mine, like I get a little slack, my four-step was really long if you didn't have one, it's okay, just follow the instructions in the book, and we don't have to debate about it and argue it in the parking lot. So I'm especially grateful to be able to carry the message here. I live in Quincy, Massachusetts. That's somewhat new. Before I lived in Quincy, I lived in Keene, New Hampshire. Before New Hampshire, I lived in southern Vermont. And that's where I moved to attain and maintain sobriety. Before I left, I lived in my home state of New York. Hell yeah. I love New York. I'm so happy to be back. I love all of you. I love this state. Every time I move further away from it, it just feels like I'm being pulled further and further away from the center of the universe, which is New York. Right? But it's not my choice. I go where the doors open and I'll do that. So, yeah. I grew up in Rockland County, New York. Yeah! And there my journey begins. I have no idea if I was born an alcoholic. I don't really care. Let's not try and figure it out or do a bunch of tests or debate it in the parking lot. Don't care. All I know is I got it. What am I going to do about it? But I can, as far as back as I can remember, I identify with this thing that I now label as the spiritual malady. I can remember that from day one. I did not feel okay. I have a fantastic memory. It's good. I have memories before I was 2 years old. And as far back as I can remember, I'm full of fear. I'm not all right. This analogy of that I don't fit in my own skin, I identify with that greatly. something's wrong with me. And I would tell myself, like, something's wrong with me. Something's wrong with me. I wouldn't vocalize it. And, like, I didn't have any friends. I absolutely knew it, because why would you ever want to be my friend? And they weren't really my friends. I had a twin brother, so really friends with him, because you can't be friends with one twin without being friends with the other one, you know? And nobody liked me. I could tell just by looking at them, oh, no, they don't like me. I can tell. It's a terrible gift to be able to know what other people are thinking just by looking at them. It's rough. It's a troubling gift. So I had that. So I have this low-level discomfort going all the time, right? And because I'm uncomfortable, I want everybody to do exactly what I want them to do without me having to ask for it in order for me to be okay. And lo and behold, they don't do that. And I start accruing these things called resentments. I'm angry, I'm annoyed, I'm mad at people because things aren't going my way. And I accrued them at a very early age, and they just kind of stuck around, and they dictate my entire life. For example, I'm talking about my twin brother. I was left back in second grade. I wasn't a good writer or reader, and my parents actually held me back. And immediately, I have a very clear resentment of that. It's like, oh, I am so stupid. That's what I am. That's what's wrong with me. Left me back, I'm stupid, right? And my parents, you know, really, it wasn't my fault. It's my parents' fault because they were always busy and they were working and never came home early, so they never read to me as a child, like at nighttime. I didn't get a bedtime story, right? So clearly, I'm not enough, and my parents don't love me. Nobody loves me. So I'm stupid, nobody loves me, I'm not enough. And when they held me back because I'm a twin, you can't hold back one twin without holding back the other. So they held him back too. Oh. Yes. Go to Al-Anon. And so it was all my fault. It's all my fault, right? That he got held back too, and of course he would be mad at me. And I remember, I mean, this may sound silly to you, it was very traumatic to me. I had this thing, I didn't get what I wanted for Christmas when I was a child. And I was really mad about it. I was mad at Santa. And the thing I did get that I didn't want had my mom's handwriting. I was very young, but I could tell that was mom's. It said Santa. So I was mad at Santa. And then I had this, you know, conclusion of the mind that, well, if Santa, so it's clearly not real. So if Santa Claus is not real, then the Tooth Fairy, that's total bubkiss. And I was mad at that guy. And this thing called the Easter Bunny, well, that totally can't be real. That's full of shit. And I had this conclusion. I was like, well, if there is no risk, if there's no Santa Claus, and there's no Easter Bunny, then there's no Tooth Fairy, and so there was no resurrection, Jesus is totally false, and there is no God. Because I didn't get what I wanted for Christmas. So here I am, a six-year-old. I'm stupid. It's all my fault. Nobody loves me. My parents don't care about me. And there is no God. So other than that, childhood was great. It was wonderful. Yeah. I had a tree fort. I would hide in the woods and stay by myself. So I had this low-level discomfort going all the time. I was just not all right, right? But I felt that all the time. That's all I ever experienced. So if that's all I experienced, I have no idea how uncomfortable I am until I got comfortable. And the first time I got comfortable was the first time I got drunk. When the first time I got drunk was at my parents' house. They were away on business, as they often were, and my sister threw a high school party, and there was plenty of people drinking. And I had been to a lot of parties before, and I always passed on it. I always passed. I had a very low opinion of alcohol than those that drank it. It was stupid. They were loud. It was obnoxious. I didn't get it. They were dumb. They were falling over. I was like, what's the point? But at this particular party, there was a girl, and she liked me. I didn't like her, but I knew she liked me, so thus I'm okay inside. Somebody likes me. And she handed me a drink, and it wasn't peer pressure. I was just like, I just got the internal okay somehow, and I took it. And that reaction happened. I very quickly started feeding myself. I drank everything that I could find. I made out with that girl on the couch in front of the entire party. I think I got second base. The entire party got up and walked out on me. I remember very clearly before I threw up, I was looking down at the makeshift bar and looking at all the bottles, and a thought occurred to me. It was my first spiritual experience. Something came over me. It was that magic. And I said to myself very clearly, I didn't know you could feel this good. It just happened. That I unwound for the first time ever. I could finally breathe in and out and be okay. And the thought that immediately preceded that was, I wonder if you can feel like that all the time. All the time. Prior to this experience, I have a very low opinion of alcohol and those that drink it. I have one. I want to feel like this always. So, and I got a bunch of large guys that had to forcibly put me to bed. But what I took away from that was like, I want to feel like this always. But I woke up the next morning, worst hangover I've ever had. And I swore off forever. I said, I'm never going to do that again. I'm done. It was that bad a hangover. I had to go in the morning to like a little kid's birthday party. And when I got there, everybody had found out, you know, I got drunk, I threw up, and made out with the girl and all this stuff, including the little kids. And I was mortified and embarrassed. My sister was so mad at me because I'm the drunken guy, you know, it's like, why did you invite your little brother to the fucking party? And so everybody, and I'd said I would never do it again. I swore forever the first time. But I'm a real alcoholic. And the next opportunity I got was actually not for several weeks. It might have even been several months. I don't remember. But I stayed away from a drink for a while. And then I got into an argument. I ran away from home. Well, I got in an argument with my dad. I ran away from home. I developed a near bottle a day habit. I tried 4 or 5 drugs in less than a week, and I was off and running. And eventually I came back. It was Father's Day. I have a conscience. I want to pretend I don't. I want to pretend I'm like a thug or a badass or a gangster. You name it, whatever. Gutter punk, fill in the blank. But I knew I couldn't, and it was Father's Day, and I ran away from home, because so I went home. But basically, high school carried on that way. So I went back, I graduated, I went to a local community college, this is Rockland County. So I started to explore and indulge everything that New York City had to offer, and it was plentiful. And I loved partying in that town. You could drink till 4:30, you could find anything you wanted. And I had arrived. This was it. I finally was part of life at last. Like, this is the bee's knees. I'm drinking all the time. I'm doing other stuff. Girls like me. I got a girlfriend. I'm working. You know, I'm in college. I'm a responsible adult. I got my car. I'm good. I'm golden. This is great. And I did that for 2 years, and, you know, a little more consequences, a little more seriousness, a little more shenanigans. I went upstate to a real university, and there my drinking took on more serious proportions, and I became a daily drinker. I had difficulty getting through college, and eventually I had this great idea that was going to fix me. I had this girlfriend, and she had a very serious pain condition, so she was on pain management. So it seemed like a very good day that I would get on pain management, too. I had a very serious fake injury. It's very serious. And so I went on pain management. We milked that for a couple of years. That, you know, escalated, as always does, intravenous drug use and a lot of serious illegal actions, a lot of round-trip vacations to Paterson, New Jersey, things of that nature. It's a lovely town. If you haven't been, you should totally go. Anyway, and so what happened is, in that college town that I was no longer welcome in and no longer going to school and no longer welcome back at that school, I crashed and burned. I had to go back to Rockland, live with mom and dad, tail tucked between my legs, and they shuffled me into detox. Now, my plan about detox, this is my plan. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go to detox. I'm going to get off the sauce. Everything's going to be fine. Then I'm going to go back out there because I just want my old life back. You know? And I got there, and they said, you can't drink anymore. And I said, literally, out loud, I didn't sign up for that. Didn't sign up for that. Thank you very much. They hammered into me the gravity, the seriousness of the situation. I was like, all right, yeah. And I was pretty broke. I had a lot of consequences happen in a short amount of time. It scared me. So I was like, okay. So I left shaking. I didn't do anything else after detox, like no aftercare program or anything like that. And so I said I would take all the suggestions. So I took all the suggestions thrown around meetings where I got sober in Rockland at that time. I took them all. So they told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. So I did. They get a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. Get a home group. So I got a home group. Get a commitment. So I started making coffee at my home group with my sponsor. And all went well for a time. You know, I kind of liked AA more than I thought I would. But I know I made it 3 months. I know I didn't make it 6. Somewhere in between, I'm thinking about my old life, and I'm craving a drink, and I'm even starting to talk about it. Like, I couldn't believe it. Like, I'm kind of thinking about drinking. And they're like, don't worry about it, kid. You'll be fine. Just keep coming. Don't drink. Go to meetings. I was like, okay. I'm doing that. And then I'm really wanting a drink. And they're like, oh, no, it'll be all right. Just keep coming. And I was like, I don't think so. Like, I really want a drink. And like, no, you'll be fine. It'll be great. Just like, meeting makers make it. I was like, all right, cool. And then I left. And I had this master plan, right? It's so good. Oh, it's beautiful. What I was going to do is I was going to go out and drink. It was a 3-day long, like, fetish Halloween party in New York City. I was going to go, and I was going to drink there, and I was going to have a grand old time. And if it got bad, I would just come back to AA. What a great plan. It's a horrible plan. It was actually 12 years ago today. It was 2 days before Halloween. I went out, and I drank, and I had an awesome time. Awesome time. So I went, I got my drink on. I had a there was a girl there, actually. It was this really cool club, you know. There was a girl, she was a fetish model. She had like a giant purple mohawk. I had a crush on her for like 9 months before I got sober. She was there, and I'm drinking, and I'm schmoozing her. Yeah. I'm getting my drink on, and I feel great. It was a porn star there. She asked if she could come home with me. I'm not lying. I'm not bragging either. I've never slept with either one of them, right? But like, let's look at this. I didn't get shot. I didn't get thrown out. I didn't get stabbed, you know? Nothing bad happened, you know? And I'm thinking to myself, I remember these crouchy, grumpy old-timers being like, you go back out there, kid, it just gets worse. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, between the fetish model and the porn star, it just gets worse. I don't think so, Grandpa. I even drove home, didn't get pulled over, no arrest, no nothing. I was like, awesome. I got my old life back and better. Except there's this really important part in this book that describes me to a T. It's called More About Alcohol. It says at times, it seems that they have regained control. Here I am, I got my own life back. Well, those times, usually brief, are followed by less control, which lead in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That is exactly what happened, and I stayed out for 6.5 years. And a series of events happened, kind of set a domino effect to land me into New England and returning to recovery. What happened is basically I worked my ass off as a daily drunk to get back into school. I had to go to 4 different schools just to go back to university. I went back to university, you know, because, like, if you can go back into university, you're not an alcoholic, right? Clearly. I have all these delusions that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I manage well. If only I get the things that I want. If only my ducks line up in a row. If only she does what I freaking want her to do, everything's going to be okay. One of the delusions that I had, as long as I graduate college, I'm going to be all right. Right? Of course. I'll have 2 degrees. I'll speak a second language. Everything's great. I graduated college. I even had 3.5 my last year as a daily drinker and using opioids, intermittently. Here and there. Just a smidge. And I couldn't believe it. I did it. I graduated college, and then I became a 24/7 round-the-clock daily drinker. I couldn't go for more than 4 hours without a drink. I woke up every day with the onset of delirium tremens or drunk from the night before. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms because mine endured that agony 2 more years. And what happened was I had one particular event. I was really mad at my girlfriend at the time. I have no idea what it was. She didn't know either. She was passed out on the couch. But I slammed the bottle of Wild Turkey 101, and I did it in about an hour. So I was like knee-walking, room-spinning drunk. But I had called Mr. Dope Man before that, and he didn't call me back, so I just started drinking. And as soon as I finished, he called me back. He lived a block and a half away. I went over to his house. And, you know, Aaron and I were old friends, but we hadn't seen each other in a while. And I don't want to diverge too off the singleness of purpose, but I was really drunk, and it sounded like a fantastic idea, so I sat down, and I shot up. Then I fell over, and I stopped breathing, and my heart stopped. It turned purple, and I died. They resuscitated me, called my girlfriend at the time, said, "Dial 911, come over and get him." She did that. I actually came to in my own driveway, coming out of her car and going into an ambulance. They gave me Narcan that takes all the opiates out of your system, exactly like that, and I distinctly remember my first coherent thought. I knew exactly what happened. Nobody had to fill me in. My first coherent thought was, wow, thank God I'm still drunk. Thank God. It says it in the doctor's opinion. While they admit it is injurious, meaning it causes me harm, they cannot, after time, differentiate the true from the false. So my idea, my thinking was, thank God I'm still drunk. So it's not like, how did my life get here again? What have I done to myself? Thank God I'm still drunk. And I went off to the hospital. I was like, way to go, doc. Thanks for saving me. I left AMA. I went home. I drank the rest of my alcohol. Then I shot the rest of my dope. Because I can't not. I just can't not. Phenomenon of craving. Abnormal reaction. Allergy I have to alcohol. Once I put any in my system, I can't stop. And I did the very same thing the next day and the day after that and the day after that. Because to me, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. It's all I know. Everything else is burnt to the ground. I couldn't remember what it was like to feel normal, to feel happy. I couldn't remember what it was like to not be messed up or sick. Couldn't remember. I had this little crappy basement apartment. How alcoholic is that? Crappy basement apartment, one window this big, right? And I remember being drunk as a skunk at 9 o'clock in the morning, just staring out at the sidewalk and watching people drive by, go to work, walk a dog, get to school, and I would think to myself, how do they do it? Just how do they do it? I just couldn't remember what it was like. Everything else was burnt to the ground. And after that little event, I was driving in a not-so-good city. It's called Newburgh. Perhaps you've been there. I've been drinking all day. I had a nighttime job, and I drank at work, and I drank after work. And an associate phoned me up, and I went, and I picked him up. We had two stops to make. I made stop one, and I was on my way to make stop two and make a goofy turn. I get pulled over. I see the lights go up. Something hits me. I don't want to do this anymore. I am so sick and tired of this. I hate my life. I hate my existence. The party has been long over, and nobody told Jeremy. So the cop pulls us out. He got arrested. He was a known felon with multiple warrants out for his arrest. He got arrested. The cop looks at me, and something came over and threw me, and I was spewing the truth, and I couldn't turn it off. And if anybody knows, if you're going to tell the truth, don't do it to a cop. Right? And he looked right at me and said, kid, if I search this car, am I going to find anything? I was like, uh-huh. He's like, have you been drinking? I said, yeah. I can't even tell with a straight face. It was so ridiculous. And he pulled me out of the car, and I showed him the stuff. It was actually a little bit of rock, crack cocaine. And he said, you seem like you do this. I was like, I don't. He said, you seem like you're a drunk and a junkie. I said, I am. And he said, you seem like you're a good kid. You just need some help. And I choked up, and I said, I do. I do need help. And after that little heart-to-heart, I went to jail. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, a girl that was foolish enough to love me up came, bailed me out. She was so mad. She was so livid. I've never seen her more mad in her entire life, actually, because I got arrested in her car, which was then impounded. So she had to wake somebody else to get in another car to come all the way down there. And she was so mad at me. And I got home, and I ran to the bottle. And I was sober. I absolutely had to. I stayed chained to a bench for like 8 hours. I had to have it. Isn't that weird? Because I just told the police officer that, yes, I'm alcoholic. Yes, I have a problem. Yes, I need help. Because self-knowledge avails me nothing. I can't stay sober on the basis of self-knowledge. You know? And so basically what happened, I'll try and cut it a little brief. What happened is my boss at the time, crappy deli job, came over. Found me drunk, 9 o'clock in the morning, because she had heard about those two events. And she said, I love you. You need help. You're fired. I was like, right. I said, and on the way over here, I called your father and told him everything. It's like, no. Really? Like, I'm an adult here. I graduated college. You called my dad? Which is so weird, because I'm so concerned about my wounded ego and not about death and jail and all this other stuff. And, you know, my ego will kill me. But I called my dad because I didn't want to do this anymore. So I called my dad, and he said, come to Vermont, go to the retreat, go to detox, live with us. And I said, okay, I had no other options. I was actually being removed from that house. I lost my job, my car's off the road, everything, right? So I go up, and I go to detox again with a firm resolution not to drink again. All right, this time I really mean it. Like, I was done. I was licked. And they had no aftercare for me. So I left detox shaking again, and I said, things are going to be okay. I'm going to go back to AA. And I went back to AA, and I took all the suggestions and that were thrown around meetings at that time. Get a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. Get a home group. So I got a home group. Get a commitment. So I got a commitment. Started making coffee at my home group, and all went well for a time. It was in the middle of nowhere in Vermont. It was middle of nowhere to me. Bunch of old-timers. Oh, it was beautiful. Oh, my God. I had a jet black mohawk, pyramid spikes, and they were like, what do we do with him? It was beautiful. Everybody, because Brattleboro was kind of close. So there's some younger people. But everybody in my home group who was young, they all turned 50 the year I got there. Like 8 of them. Like, I'm 50, you're 52, we're all so many. I was like, yay. And there's Jeremy. But I liked it a whole lot more than I wanted to admit. You know, when I got busy, and I remember I got my six-month coin, and I was flabbergasted because I hadn't been sober for 6 months, probably till I was 15 years old. And I relapsed that night, and I couldn't figure out why. I came to Vermont. I don't want to drink anymore. I really meant it. Like, I had written a lot of sweet promises, but this time I meant business, and it's true. So I guess it was a momentary weakness. That's what I chalked it up to. So I said, I'll redouble my efforts. So I went to more meetings, and I showed up early, and I stayed late, and I called more alcoholics, and I went on a lot of rides with a lot of grumpy alcoholics. And then I drank again. And then I drank again. And again and again and again. In AA, a meeting-making fool without my own permission. I'm going to share one of those relapse stories that pretty much sums up what's wrong with me as a real alcoholic. So one of these days, I was craving a drink, but I didn't want to drink anymore. But I'm craving it, and I know it. So I go to 3 meetings in 1 day, which is really tough to do in southern Vermont, let me tell you, right? And I go to the meeting early, and I stay late, and I raise my hand, and I talk to people before the meeting, during the meeting, after the meeting. I want a drink. I want a drink. And I raise my hand, and I called my sponsor. I want a drink. And I distinctly remember the last meeting. I heard a lot of things said at that meeting that I've been hearing for a long time that I now know do not actually apply to me. They're like a series of half-truths said by a lot of well-meaning, intended people that meant no harm, but it doesn't hold true for me. And they told me that meeting makers make it, but my experience is I've been making it to an awful lot of meetings, and I keep drinking. They go, hey, kid, just put the plug in the jug, and you'll be all right. My experience is I put the plug in the jug. Eventually, I take it out, I drink it, and then I go get another jug because I can't not. They said, just don't drink and come to meetings. I was like, well, those are important, by the way. Time out. Important. Going to meetings, very important. Can't stay sober without it. Not drinking, obviously, priority. But they said, just don't drink and go to meetings. I was like, I can't do that. Like, if you want me to drink and come to meetings, I'm like, I'm really good at that. You know, if you want me to, I got it. Check. You know, but I can't. Here's, ready? Ready? Powerful. Just don't drink no matter what. It's deep. I drink no matter what. I drink no matter what. I can't not. Right? Don't tell me I'm powerless over alcohol and then just say, hey, Chiz, just choose not to drink today. Can't do it. So I got out of, there's more truth to it. We'll get there. Don't worry. So I got out of that meeting, and I'm so thirsty, and I'm in downtown Brattleboro. I'm looking at all those neon lights, and I'm thirsty, and I'm craving a drink. And they told me to play the tape, so I start to do that, and I'm thinking about it. It's like, and a thought occurred to me. It's like, wait a minute. I can't even drink if I wanted to. I just got out of an AA meeting. Someone from AA will see me. And suddenly a thought crossed my mind. There's a bar in Northampton, Massachusetts. I've drank there before. I can drink there, and no one from AA will see me. Problem solved. Because I have this peculiar mental twist that just flips the truth on me. My problem being alcoholism, I hate my life, I'm going to drink again and die. It pushes that easily aside for the insane idea that I can drink in safety as long as no one from AA sees me. Right? I have these blank spots. I cannot remember the past consequences that have come up or the future inevitable consequences that will happen. They do not occur to me. Mental obsession. So when I have this grandiose thought, I'm on my way home already, so I'm just like, well, I'll just change my clothes and go right back out and go to this club. And the obsession was so strong, I had to drink the first thing that was in front of me, which was a bottle of Listerine. See, the other part of my alcoholism, I have this abnormal reaction, the allergy, the phenomenon of craving. Once I start, I can't stop. So I drank a second bottle of Listerine. And believe me, the first one wasn't good. Then I stopped at the package store. I drank two tall boys. I went to the bar. I drank at the bar. I yelled at the bartender for not serving me fast enough. I closed that bar. And then I went home, and I drank everything that I could find that my parents hadn't hidden on their alcoholic son. Then I woke up the next morning wondering why it had all happened. I went to 3 meetings in 1 day. I called my sponsor. I raised my hand. What's wrong with me? Well, it's not their fault. I wrote it was their fault. It's not their fault. See, it describes what's wrong with me in this book, in a chapter called We Agnostics, and it says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live a life on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Very true. When I came back to AA, I was the guy that was described as violently anti-religious. I was extremely opposed to all spiritual terms. I would literally, there's a term in the book, bristle with antagonism to mere mention of spiritual terms. Right? This little vein would pop out of my head, like, don't give me that God shit again, I'm not going to have it. Right? And this old timer who had been sober 20 years longer than I'd been alive would be like, hey, kid, you're hitting your knees? And I'd be like, no. I'm still friends with him, by the way. But I kept drinking. You know, and I used to brag to people, make them uncomfortable, have my tattoo artist was a Satanist and a Hell's Angel, just to make you uncomfortable, right? I used to fornicate in church basements, get the back at them. You know, I used to listen to my black metal very loudly with my windows down as your church congregation got out on Sunday morning, just minding my own business. And anything that I could throw back at them, because I was so uncomfortable, I'm not going to have it. But I was getting pretty badly mangled. And people were talking to me about this whole higher power thing. And I knew you meant God. You're not going to fool me, higher power. I know what you mean. Can't trick this guy. Clever. And they were talking about a higher power, and they said it could be anything you want. And I was like, well, that doesn't really make any sense. They said, well, it could be a light bulb. And I was like, well, that's stupid. Light bulbs burn out. They break. Just made me want to smash all the lights anyway. Like, smash, God is dead. I win. Nietzsche was right. Nietzsche was right. You prick. Or it could be a doorknob. Well, doorknobs rust. They fall off. And anyway, so. But then I drank again. And then I drank again. So I had this thought this one time. And I'm going to share it with you. I'm going to tell you right now, I didn't do anything with this thought, but. Has anyone ever seen the movie Star Wars? Yeah? Yes, okay. So I had an idea that maybe I could make the Force my higher power. Oh, cool. So what I didn't know then, but I know now, it says a whole lot of important stuff in this book, right? Because in Star Wars, it says that the Force is what gives a Jedi Knight his power, right? What does it say in the big book? Lack of power. That is my dilemma. I had to find the power by which I could live, and it had to be a power greater than myself. Huh, makes sense, right? Describes the Force as being an energy field created by all living things in the big book, right? No. I had it switched. Let me go back. The Force in Star Wars is described as an energy field created by all living things. But in the big book, it says God is everything or he is nothing, okay? It describes the Force as this thing that it surrounds us, it binds us, it penetrates us, like in Bill's story, like the wind of a clean mountaintop blowing through and through. It says that a Jedi can feel the Force flowing through him, all right? Many times it talks about some energy flowing through. It says in the third set promises, we felt new power flow in. Makes sense, right? And actually, when Luke is talking to Yoda, a.k.a. his grand sponsor, Just saying. He's trying to distinguish, well, how am I going to determine the good side from the bad, the Force? And he said, is it stronger? And he said, no, it's quicker, more seductive. We tried to find, and it says in the big book, we tried to find an easier and softer way, right? I didn't know any of that. I also didn't know that George Lucas, when coming up with his conception of the Force, studied a lot of Eastern religions and philosophies. Didn't know that. I also didn't know in this really important book called Varieties of Religious Experiences by William James, he sums up in the back of the book all these conversion, religious, and spiritual experiences into one godlike term, which he called the More, capital M-O-R-E. William James is cited twice in this book, right? The More. He's the father of American psychology. If that guy can call it the More, I can call it the Force. Right? Except I didn't know any of that. Nobody read me that book. I didn't read that book. I had no knowledge of that whatsoever. What remained in me was the vestiges of my old past. And the worldly clamors, what was going on up in here, and what that looked like at that time. Was don't tell anyone that, Jeremy. That's just stupid. That's dumb. And more importantly, if you do take that, you caved. They broke you. You drank the Kool-Aid. You are really one of those religious, hypocritical nut jobs. Get in line, sheep. And then I drank again. And then I drank again and again. And the last time I got drunk, I was drunk for 2 weeks straight. I came to in my parents' bathroom, and I'd been puking blood, and stomach bile was coming out of my nose and seeping out of my tear ducts. And I was greatly disturbed because this has happened to me before. And I knew it was going to happen to me again. And I was going to die. And I didn't know what to do. And the thought came to me that I should call Howard, my grand sponsor, because he was old and he could meet me early. So I went over to the 5:30 meeting, and I met Howard, and he quickly whisked me over into the little children's playroom because he was embarrassed for me because I was totally disheveled. I hadn't showered or bathed, shaved, I don't know how long. I had stomach, all sorts of bodily fluids all over me, and I was wearing a cutoff t-shirt, and it was February. And I sat down at a little embarrassing plastic table. And I was so embarrassed, and I told Howard everything, and I told him what was going on and what I had been doing, and I said, I can't stop. I just can't stop. And Howard sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. And my ideas of miracles were drastically revised right there. And he shouted great tidings. And he asked me to do the one thing that I was not willing to do. He said, pray with me. So I said, okay. And we got on our knees, and I held his hands. And I have no idea if Howard said anything at all. And I don't know if I spoke it or if I thought it. I just said, please. Please help me. I can't. I just can't do this anymore. And I walked out of that room a free man. I have never had the obsession, desire, compulsion to drink from that moment to this. It was a little over 5.5 years ago. You act like I did anything. Quite important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. I have since been brought into a way of life infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful than my last. I would not go back to my old one even if I could. I have been risen from the alcoholic scrap heap to a level of life better than the best I've ever known. And I woke up the next morning on fire. I'm the guy on fire. I'm not the only one. We are growing in numbers and power. Yeah! AA's making a comeback in AA. Who'd have thunk it? And I wanted more of that, and I had no idea how to get it, and I didn't even want to admit it, because who wants to be a hypocrite, really? Like, okay, you were right. Chump. So I went to my sponsor, totally excited, elated, I'm sharing what I'm doing, and I was like, yeah, I want to write a 4-step, I want to get into the steps, I'm going to be all right. And they're like, whoa, you just drank, you're on step one. I was like, okay, and they were kind of right, actually, but like, I looked at powerless, unmanageable, I was like, I think I get it. What's next? Right? And I ran around the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous sharing this thing, wanting to do more, and they said, that's great, kid, just keep coming. I was like, all right, but what's next? Right? And they're like, well, just meeting makers make it. And I was like, whoa. No, like, for real, like, what's next? And they're like, well, just put the plug in the jug. I was like, well, don't work me, hold up, let's go back. There's 12 of them up there. What's next? I'm like, just keep coming. I was like, I'm still here. Like, what's next? And to make a long story short, I spent the next year and a half running around the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to figure out what's next, being a meeting-making fool. And I tried to work the steps on my own, and don't do that, please. The results were disastrous. I didn't get better. But it's actually described very eloquently in this book called Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss. It's called The Waiting Place. And I was just waiting to get well, and I'm not getting well, and I'm waiting to feel better. I'm not feeling better, you know, and the screws are starting to tighten, and it's getting really loud up here, and I'm uncomfortable again, and I'm wondering, why don't I have a girlfriend? Why am I not making a lot of money? Why am I still in Vermont? Like, totally ungrateful. And I'm untreated, and I don't even know it. What's next? And then what happened to me is I ran into a guy who's describing this book. His whole department shouts, he is a man with a real answer. The lights are on and somebody was home. This guy was different. He was very calm. He was a young guy, and he'd been sober at least twice as long as I was at that time. His buddy, his name is Nick. He's now my 10-step buddy. And we had been we talked for 5 minutes, and this guy had me sold. And he said, there's this meeting in Keene. My friend Bruce started that meeting. Why don't you go there and listen and check on my friend Bruce? And I went to, it's the Big Book Step Study meeting in Keene, New Hampshire. It's on 5 to 6:30 on Sundays. And I went there and I listened to this guy, Bruce, just shares. The meeting went around for 5 minutes. And I liked it. And I went back next Sunday. And that guy, he carried a message of depth and weight. He knew what he was talking about. He talked about drinking without his own permission for 38 years. Waking up every day saying, today's the day I'm going to quit drinking. I identified. I said, I got to ask this guy for help. And I said, well, I'll do it next Sunday. I still get goosebumps. I couldn't wait. It was Monday morning. It was the next day. I called up Nick. I said, give me that guy's number right now. And I called him up. I asked him, will you help me? Will you take me through the work? He said he'd be honored. I said, great. I swear to God, I said it word for word. What's next? He said, next, he always knew what was next because someone had taken the time to take him through. He said, next, I want you to read the doctor's opinion up to page 63 and stop where I tell you to stop. I want you to underline things that are important, significant, that stick out to you, that you can identify with. Circle the words you're not familiar with. Look those words up and write them in the margin. And we're all done with that. We'll read it together. And I did that. And we're all done. We read it together. And then I got on my knees and I held his hands and I offered myself to God as I then understand him. I don't understand him now. And that's okay. And I took a formal third-step prayer. I put pen to paper. I wrote a four-step. It was very long. I've been resentful since birth and have a fantastic memory. It was 2,200 pages long. When I was all done, I read the thing to him. It took me 70 hours just to read the thing to him. Then I went home. I took my hour with God. I put the book on the shelf. I took the book off the shelf because it says take the book off the shelf, so I don't know what else to do. I clearly saw that I didn't want to be this giant four-step guy anymore, so I was very, very willing and entirely ready, so I asked him to take it, and I did six and seven. Whatever was left over, I have to deal with, and I made a list of all persons I had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. I went out and made amends. I made amends to all of them. I'm making two financial payments. I made amends to all of them. I get off your ass and go. And I make do 10, 11, 12 every day to the best of my ability, which means I continue to take personal inventory. I right the wrongs as they come up. I open and close my day with prayer and meditation, you know, and I sponsor an awful lot of guys. You know, I practice these principles in all my affairs, which I don't actually do a great job, but I work really, really hard at it. And I carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I do it in jails, institutions, detoxes, halfway houses, sober houses, rehabs, you know, conventions, potlucks, plain ordinary whoopee parties. And I have had a spiritual awakening as the result. And I'm not the same. In a good way. Like I'm not all better. I have a lot of conversations with my sponsor how I'm not all better, but I am better. And I've been better than I was last year and the year before that. And if I continue to do this work, and I do continue to do this work, I will get better still. And it's an amazing journey. I'd love to share a bunch of spiritual experiences and things that have happened to me along that path and after still. Do I have time? Sure I do. Why not? So I remember when I was taking my third step, like nothing really significant happened. We were reading at the local Burger King, and I knew I had to get on my knees and hold hands with another man, so I asked if we could just, you know, go to my house. It's just right around the corner. Could we just go there and do that, please? And he said, okay. By the way, I have taken a third step in the jail, which I know now what that looks like. It's a fishbowl, all the word to see. And I said, okay. I've actually taken two third steps with other guys in that very jail. But this time, I didn't really want to do that, so we went back. So nothing really happened for me on my third step, but I did make a commitment that I would finish this work. That's really, it's this decision. I'm not turning my will and my life over to God on the third step. It's part of it. That's where my journey begins to do that. I don't actually know how to do that. I have no idea. That's where the rest of it comes. I'm just making a decision to do so. I said, okay. So I had agreed to him, God, and myself that I would finish this work, and I was done. I would take another man through, and obviously I've made good on that. And so I put pen to paper. And God, I was angry. I had no idea how sick I was until I started to get well. I have no idea. No idea. And I was just mad at everything, and they weren't doing it right, and I was full of fear, and, you know, my sex conduct didn't look that great. But, you know, I'm not the devil either. Like, that would have been great. How fantastic would that be? Like, I was really evil. Then I'd really have a reason why I'm so messed up. But in actuality, I was just sick. I have an experience I like to tell. It gives a little bit of hope for me. So obviously my fourth step was tremendously long. I spent a long time writing it, and I pretty much pushed a lot of stuff aside. And I remember this one time my sister begged me to come over. She's like, come over, we'll never see you. You're only in one town away, blah, blah, blah. I was like, fine. And I didn't want to be there. I went over, and God, it smelled. She had a little boy. He was like a little toddler, and he stunk. She had a dog. It was a mangy dog. It smelled. And I was like, I don't want to be here. Like, I literally told myself, I should be writing inventory. Like, I don't want to be here. And the conversation came up that she was getting a lot of support from our parents, who lived right down the road, in babysitting for her child. And it was like, so great, and it was like wonderful, because mom and dad weren't around for us when we were little, and then that old resentment came right back. Mom and dad weren't around, and they didn't love me, and they didn't care. And you know what? And they didn't read to me. If they had read to me, then I wouldn't have gotten left back. I wouldn't have been stupid. It wouldn't have been all my fault and all this other stuff. And as I'm like re-airing this resentment in the middle of my fourth step, I feel this little tug, 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 and I look down, and what I see is her little boy doing this. And he had a book in his hand, and I said, well, what's that? And he said, she said, he wants you to read him a story. So I picked up that little tyke, and I put him on my knee, and I read him a story, and then he got down, and he grabbed another book, and I read him another story. And another story, and it was like 4 or 5 books, and I got free. I saw in that moment that my parents, not only did they do the best they could, they did a pretty good job. They were loving. They were around, but they also had to work and support 3 kids that were born in less than 3 years. I'm a twin, right? And not only that, was I so bitter, I would have gladly deprived that little boy of what I felt I didn't get, you know, you little jerk, because I'm so resentful, and I got free, and I have a tremendous, tremendous amounts of experience of getting free through the process of inventory and reading it to my sponsor, which, I mean, he basically laughed his ass off when he heard it. He thought it was the funniest thing ever, because most of it's just trivial minutia, just BS, just like, oh, my mama girlfriend left me. It's like, oh, God, I would have left me too. Like, I had a long way to go. But, you know, it was just this process. When I read my fifth step, basically, it was like I had erected this wall, or actually it's like a suit of armor to keep me safe from you, because you were going to take this away, or you weren't going to do what I wanted, and you were going to hurt me or leave me or do this or do that, whatever it was. And as I read this thing, I just slowly took that armor off piece by piece, and I stood there vulnerable and healed. And it was a wonderful experience. And I got a lot of freedom. And 6 and 7, not much happened at that time. I was very willing. I went home, as I said, I read it. Something happened later, the fact. These removals of character defects, which always kind of confuse me. It's like, it's really not my job. Like, sure, if something's coming up and I think it's causing harm and I don't like it or I'm uncomfortable, that's really my middle finger, I'm uncomfortable, I'll ask for it to be removed, but it's really, I got to do the work and leave the results up to God. And as I said, I made a list. It's 100 people long. Well, it was a lot longer than that, but I crossed them off. And I didn't owe them amends, that's all. But I started making those amends, and it was really powerful, some cool ones. I'll talk about probably my mom, because that was a big one. But I remember I was in Lower Manhattan, and I had 3 amends to make in New York City in one day. I always drove down from Vermont. And this whole 6 and 7, this ideas of changing and not being on my time. So I made 2 amends, and I was happy. It was going good. I had a lot of time to kill, all the way to amends 3. And I'm always hungry. I'm always eating. So I find this little crappy Chinese place, and it's tiny. It's one little bench and a wall of mirrors. And I'm like, well, this is uncomfortable. Okay, I'll just eat my Chinese food. And what I'm doing is, I'm eating my Chinese food, and I look up, and I catch my own gaze, my own reflection. I lock eyes with me, and a voice came over. It came in. It was my voice, but it wasn't for me. And he said, hey, you know that guy, Jeremy? He's okay. He's okay. And if I hated you on my 4-step in past life, I hated me a whole lot worse. Nothing was okay about Jeremy. I wasn't tall enough. I wasn't big enough. I wasn't good and looking enough. I was never enough. In that moment, I was enough. I had healed. And I'd love to tell you that from there to now, I've always been enough. Not true. But I've never had that level of self-hatred and self-loathing from that moment. It hasn't happened. It just something came over me. And I was crying. Of course, I cry a lot. I don't really mind. And I don't apologize for it. Yeah. Damn straight.
Absolutely.
And so I left crying. I left my Chinese food. I grabbed my phone, my crappy flip folks. I had no money. And I called my sponsor. And I was like, I'm getting better. Like, I'm getting better. And he said, yeah, you are. You're changing. And I'm getting better. And, you know, when I made that third amends, and it was beautiful. When I made amends to my parents, I made it together and separate, because there's a bunch of things that, and I wanted them to be able to tell whatever, and they both went well, and of course, they both had, like, is there anything else, because I gotta let, you know, I tell them what I have to make amends for, I explain how sorry I was, and what I would have done differently, and I ask them if there's anything else, anything I can do to make it right, and when they had plenty of stuff. I love my dad. He's like, you've ruined every family vacation! Oh, God, but he's kind of right. Not totally right, but close to it. And I made amends to that. And you know what? We went on a family vacation sober. And I was not 100% spiritually fit, but by God, I did a much better job. The entire family, like, we're all adults and significant others. There's like 9 of us and my sister's little boy. This was a year and a half. It was amazing. You know, so I try and, you know, right the wrongs to the best of my ability, because they're owed one. They're owed an amends. This is not just about me staying sober. So, and I made amends to my mother, and one of the things, I mean, I did this, and I did that, and I fixed that, but the main thing that my mother said was, all we ever wanted to do was to let you know that we loved you, and you wouldn't let us. You would never let us in, and it, like, burned, and so what I do is I go home and let my parents know that I'm loved, and I get it. And I experience it, and I receive and give love. I just do the best I can. Like, they still, like, push my buttons like nothing else. And I have no business not praying before I go into that house. But, you know, it was much better. I would like to, I take a lot of inventory. I made all my amends. I'm going to get down there. I have an 11-step routine it's pretty solid. I do it. And I developed it many years ago. It keeps me fit. It keeps me sober. But what really reminds me is this one particular story. Again, I was resentful. I was with that buddy Nick. We were outreaching Niski, and we were driving, and I'm carrying the message all over New England. I was the outreach chair. All over New England. All over the Northeast, actually. I came into New York, and I went to Albany Young People's, and I went out here, and I went down to Rockland. I went everywhere. And I'm seeing a lot of people that on the committee, even, that aren't doing this. And I'm writing inventory like a madman, and I'm praying, and I'm meditating. I get up at 4:30 every morning, and I meditate for half an hour, and I write for half an hour, and then I go to work, and I'm, like, helping newcomers, and I'm doing all this stuff. And I see tons of people, especially where I got sober, and they weren't doing this. Not doing it, not so much. And I'm like, just airing this resentment to my 10-step buddy, Nick. And he shared in a story. I'm not religious. Nick was. And I try and make right where... see where religious people are right, and I'm trying to make use of what they have to offer. And they have a lot to offer, and I don't have to agree with everything. That's a beautiful thing. I don't have to agree with it. And what Nick shared to me is that he was listening to a radio program as a preacher, and she was explaining that she had looked around her congregation, and she did a lot. She, you know, went to the food bank and helped with the homeless, and she'd give the sermon, and she's doing Sunday school, and she's doing all this stuff, and she looks around her congregation, and she's not seeing that people that are doing the same thing. And she's starting to get annoyed by it, and she's getting burned, and she's resentful. And she actually took it to God, and what she calls guidance, I call meditation. And she asked her God, you know, why do I have to do all this stuff? Why do I see all these other people getting away with the same, you know, and not doing what I have to do? And what came back to her in her guidance is, you're asking for a lot. Do you want it or not? I'm asking for a lot. Do I want it or not? Like, I don't know if you've noticed, I'm a little tightly wound, just a bit, right? So I'm a squirrely individual, right? I'm asking do I want a little peace of mind, a little bit of serenity, a little bit of feeling usefulness to you? I'm asking for a lot, do I want it or not? So that's why I write inventory and do a nightly review every freaking night and do prayer and meditation every night and every morning, and I never miss it. And it fills me up inside. I'm probably running out of time. It does say that frequent contact with newcomers is the bright spot of our lives. It's true. I love sponsoring guys. I take them through the work. That's my job as a sponsor, to take them through the 12 steps. It's not a phone buddy. I'm not a taxi. Like, I'll talk to them and give them rides, but we're working the 12 steps and we're not working. It's very clear. That's my instructions. And, you know, it is the bright spot of my life. It doesn't really say in the book how much of a pain in the ass that it can be. That's just me not being super spiritually fit, probably. Because sometimes when I tell myself, why does it feel like I'm a babysitter? It's probably because I'm babysitting them and I'm forgetting my role. It's their job to do the work. It's my job to guide them. That's it. I forget that a lot. And it's wonderful. And I take guys through the steps, and that's how I stay sober. That's paramount. Carrying the message and working with other guys is number one for me. And I love it more than anything else. I would like to tell a quick story about having fun in sobriety before I shut up. Because when I came to, especially Vermont, like, life's over, forget it, can't drink anymore. I don't want to drink anymore, but life's over. And I distinctly remember that actually it's my first meeting, I'm pretty sure it was my first meeting ever in that detox. I'm on T5 at Good Sam. I'm up there, and there's a panel of speakers, and there's like five people, and they're all trying to sell me on AA and sobriety, and I'm not buying it. They're telling me how great it is and how wonderful the lives are, and it all sounds so lame and boring. And we got the last speaker, and God bless this woman. She was trying to, you know, force feed this stuff on me, and I'm not having it. And she's saying, oh, sobriety is so much fun. Oh, it's great. It's wonderful. We go bowling. It's like, really? Are you for real? Like, bowling? Like, that's what you have to offer? Like, I remember partying in Europe. Like, they called it study abroad. I called it drinking in Europe, you know, potato, potato. And so, like, I remember going drinking to, like, dawn in clubs, like, with, like, half-naked girls in metal cages swinging from the ceiling. Like, I'm supposed to give that up for bowling? Are you kidding me? I've actually gone bowling a couple times in sobriety. I had a really good time. I highly recommend it. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. Go bowling! And what I've come to learn, especially now I'm a little more comfortable in my own sober life, and that's true, we can get comfortable, right? Because alcohol is a solution for alcoholism. It cures what ails me. So if you take alcohol, drugs work too. If you take alcohol away from me, I need another solution, and it has to work as good or better, or I will drink again or kill myself, right? So I need a solution in my life. So now that I'm living the solution and I am comfortable sober, one of the things that I realize is fun is just what you make it. Like, I don't need to be entertained and elated at all times. I'm just happy and comfortable, and then fun just kind of arises. You know, and more important than the having fun is I have a life of value and substance. Real meaning. Like, can anyone identify with thinking back, just life being a total void, have no idea what we're doing, where we're going, just complete emptiness, no clue about what life is really about? I no longer suffer that way. I have a sense of purpose and direction. Hell yeah. And it fills me up inside, right? It fills me up inside. You know, all the stuff that I must do, you can take any suggestions you want, all the stuff that I must do in order to stay sober, that's the stuff that makes my life fantastic. Fantastic. It's wonderful. Like, it's not perfect by any stretch of the means, and I am my own worst enemy, big time. Like, I didn't want to move to Quincy. I didn't want to move to Quincy at all. I didn't want to move to New Hampshire. I didn't want to move to Vermont. But I just go where the door's open, where God is leading me. And I got very uncomfortable when I moved to Quincy. Really uncomfortable. Because, like, so my support, gone. Don't know anybody. I'm all alone, right? I broke up with my girlfriend 2 months before that because it wasn't working, right? So I'm single. Here's Boston. Look out. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, boy, what do I do? Oh, boy. You know, I'm just flooded with all these ideas of all these things that I could do. And it's just like, I don't know what to do. And, you know, I have all, you know, the thoughts started to roll, and I was really contemplating, well, maybe I should probably start dating. That would be good, you know. Maybe I should check out, like, I'm sure this, like, whole Tinder app, it's probably got, like, a spiritually fit setting, right? Probably. This girl up front, mm-mm, it doesn't. And I never found out. But so I just explained to one of my friends where I was going. It's popping up in my nightly review, and I'm taking care of Jeremy. Actually, a friend of mine recommended stay single intentionally, no flirting, no googly eyes, no come hither, none of that. Just do it for 3 months. Try it out for 90 days. And that's what I'm doing. I'm 100% abstinent. I don't know if that... okay. So, yeah, it's... very uncomfortable. Hooray! But see, the thing is, it is uncomfortable, but I'm getting comfortable. I'm getting comfortable with the idea of just being with me. It's just me and God. It's crazy. God, best girlfriend ever. Ever. Woo! You know? And that, you know, when my 90 days up and God see fit, whatever, I'm going to let him run the show. Show me what you do. Because I don't really know what God's will is. I head in that general direction, right? But I don't actually know. You all are like, so AA is the anchor in the sea of confusion, right? Okay? So we'll roll with that aquatic analogy. So God's will is a lot like sailing, okay? Like, if I sail, I can use the wind to guide me. I use God's direction. So I don't know exactly where I'm going. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but it goes in a general direction. Has anyone ever tried, or imagine what you can imagine it, try and sail against the wind? It's not going to work out very well. You're not going to go very far, right? But if I go where God sends me, things seem to work out okay. And that's what I've realized. That's what it's like trusting and relying on God, that everything is actually going to be okay. And the force flows through. And the force is strong in my family. It is. My sponsor has it. And I have it. And my sponsees have it. And you can have that power too. I'm going to read you one thing about God's will because I have no idea. And this guy didn't really have a huge idea either. But he seemed to make good use of it. He is my favorite prayer. He was a monk. Later became a priest. And he used... He was a practitioner of Buddhism, and it's about God's will and the path. It's written by Thomas Merton. It reads, "My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself, and the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean I am actually doing so, but I believe that the desire to please you does, in fact, please you, and I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope I will never do anything apart from that desire, and I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost in the shadow of death. I will fear not, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone." I hope you can make use of that prayer or anything else that I've said, and I've hoped I've helped someone. Just remember, force will be with you, always. That's all I got. God bless. Thank you.